the fact that there are African Americans and whites in our society, it's a blessing that sometimes feels like a burden to everybody. I said, oh my God, you know. But that's, and I said, no matter how hard we try, I mean, I meet a lot of Jews, I meet a lot of Arab Americans, I meet a lot of Presbyterians as well as Muslims who try hard to be objective. They say, well, I think I understand something of what the other side feels. But then they come back with a statement that basically reflects the side that they feel most connected to. But no matter how hard we try to be objective, I think we don't adequately understand the situation unless we're engaged with people who come at it with ties to the side that we feel less tied to. Third reason that I think it's important is I think to be politically effective, which we all know, and you know, God bless Senator Marty, who's here this week, for trying and trying and trying on these issues, but we all know that we sometimes are not effective. That we write to our member of Congress, etc., but it doesn't seem to do any good. All I would say about it is I think to the extent that we're able to approach members of Congress or the administration together as Jews, Christians, and Muslims, the chance of our having some effect is probably a little bit better than if we approach the administration or Congress separately, and particularly if we approach members of Congress in conflict with each other. I mean, if you're a member of Congress and you got Jews coming in one door saying one sort of thing and Presbyterians coming in the other saying something opposite, the inclination of the congressman is to talk about another issue. So I'm saying I think in terms of political effectiveness, it's helpful if we can work together. Now, it's also difficult. I'd be a fool to talk about this idea of interreligious cooperation without talking about how it's difficult, how it's hard, sometimes feels impossible. And what are some of the reasons? Well, one of the reasons is the nature of the conflict. This conflict, the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict, has been a conflict for many years where each side wanted the other to disappear. To put it crudely, but I think fairly, each side wanted the other to disappear. The Palestinians and the Arabs in general wanted Israel gone. They didn't accept the idea that Israel should be there. From their point of view, the creation of Israel was a grave injustice to Arabs. One of the ways they put it was, why should we have to suffer for what the Nazis did? Why didn't you create Israel as part of Germany? You know, and there's a moral logic to what they're saying. I mean, in a certain sense, it doesn't help much, that perception, because that's not where Israel was going to be or is. But you understand it. And from the Israeli point of view, the Israelis certainly never had the idea that all the Arabs should disappear. But the Palestinians is another matter. Because the Palestinians, of course, claim the very same land that Israel claimed. Story from our own personal experience, Carol and I were, this job we did for the Quakers, we did together, Carol and I did. I think we learned after that maybe we shouldn't do jobs together. Carol feels even more strongly than I do. That had to do with male-female dynamics, pardon. We were in a shop in the old city in Jerusalem, and an American woman was looking at things, and she picked up she saw a pendant on the clerk, and it was a pendant that was the shape, can you picture the shape of Israel? And that's what she said. Oh, that's beautiful. That's Israel. And the woman said, La, Arabic for no, Palestine. Palestine. It was the same map, you know, the same shape. From one point of view, it was Israel. From another point of view, it was Palestine. And so part of why it's difficult is this conflict, and I'd say from 1948 to the late 80s, was a conflict where each side wanted the other to disappear. That makes it difficult. Second, I referred to our ties to people in the conflict. Well, it's no mystery that American Jews have ties to people in Israel. Family ties, in part, but also communal ties. Ties are like tribal ties. I mean Jews to Jews. And the whole idea of the Jewish right of return, which sort of symbolizes that sense of connectedness to that particular place. And so, obviously, for many American Jews, the conflict is seen from an Israeli point of view. And for Presbyterians have been in the Middle East for 150, 200 years. They started schools there, some of the best schools in the region, American University of Beirut.
Was started by Presbyterians. And so is it surprising that Presbyterians have strong ties to Arab culture, Arab people, Arab history? No, no.
Lutherans have, we have Palestinian Lutherans, Catholics, etc. And American Muslims, of course, have their ties to the land, to the place, as part of the story, the Muslim story, and Muhammad's night journey to Jerusalem, a very important and thing which makes Jerusalem so, it's the second holiest place to Muslims. So we have these ties, and these ties inevitably affect how we see things. Where we hear from people we hear from, things we read, or experiences we have when we go over there. You know, you go as a visitor, even Christian, a non-Jewish visitor, and just go to Israel, you get a certain sense of what's going on. If you go as a Christian and you only go to Gaza, you get a very different sense. There was a project one summer, it was called View Israel. And it was a work camp in Gaza. Well, if you look at Israel from Gaza, I can tell you it doesn't look terrific. It doesn't look terrific. I mean, it looks awful, basically. Because what do you experience of Israel in Gaza? You don't experience the beach at Tel Aviv. You don't experience, you know, the sort of freewheeling political discussions on a bus in Jerusalem. What you experience is Israeli soldiers. So what I'm saying is that part of what makes this conflict difficult to work together on is that we have these ties, and they're real, and they pull us. They pull us. When events happen, we're pulled by these different sides. I think another reason that we have difficulty working on this, and this is particularly maybe for people who work for peace and justice, who have a commitment in their life, in our lives, to work for peace and justice, is, you know, I said the other day that one of the problems with U.S. foreign policy is that U.S. foreign policy tends to like to view the world as good versus evil. Well, if you'll pardon the analogy, I have a feeling that people who work for peace and justice, we also like to view things from the standpoint of good and evil. I mean, we like our conflict to be relatively simple so that we can say, that's what's wrong. And, you know, there are conflicts that lend themselves to that kind of view more than others. And what I'm saying about this one, I don't think it lends itself easily to that sort of view, but I think we sometimes try to push it into that kind of view. And there's enough evidence that if you are inclined to lean toward one side or the other, you can see that side as basically the good side and the other side as the problem or the evil side. Part of that relates to our own experience working for peace and justice. I think we inevitably tend to work from our experience and in a certain sense work by analogy. Work by analogy. So, you know, when Jews hear Arabs say they want Israel to disappear, it's not surprising that Jews hear Nazis. People work by analogy, you know. Hey, we've heard that before, you know. And when Christian friend says, oh, that's just rhetoric, Jews look at them as if they're out of their mind. In other words, Jews say, we've heard that rhetoric before, and we happen to believe it. You want to call it rhetoric. You know? On the opposite side, you know, we as non-Jews, we look at what's happening to Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, and we see apartheid. We see apartheid. And we sort of analogize. We say, well, it's not quite apartheid, but it's like apartheid. The problem with those analogies, I think, is that, to put it directly, the Arabs are not Nazis. And the reasons why Arabs hate Israel are not the same kind of reasons as why Nazis wanted to get rid of all the Jews. But, you know, it's not surprising that Jews hear what Arabs are saying, or for instance right now what Hamas is saying, as similar to what they heard from Nazis and react accordingly. Well, if Palestinians and Arabs are not Nazis, Israel is not South Africa. It's a different situation, which is not to say there aren't analogous things going on in the West Bank to what went on in South Africa. And at first, it's interesting. The first person I ever heard use the word apartheid to describe what was going on in the West Bank in terms of Jewish settlements was not Jimmy Carter. It was Abe Eman, the foreign minister of Israel, who, if you know his background, was South African. He came from South Africa. But Abe Eman never confused Israel with white South Africa. He saw there were differences in terms of the moral legitimacy of Israel compared to the moral legitimacy of white South Africa. But when we use those analogies, we tend to blur them a little bit, or they blur in our mind, and so we, you know, we can get in some pretty conversations. Now, this way of seeing the conflict, you know, leads to what I call pretty strong partisan advocacy. So for some, the simple truth about the conflict is that it can be ended if the occupation is ended. The occupation, Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza. If you end that, the conflict will end. Well, the simple truth on the other side, if terrorism would stop, the conflict can be resolved. Simple. And let me not, you know, even though I'm critical of those simple views, let me not in the slightest sound as if I'm saying there isn't a basis for saying those two things. In other words, there's a lot of evidence you can produce that backs up both of those positions. But when a group takes one of those positions and other people take the other position, it's like this. They're just sort of shouting at each other. Stop the occupation, that's the key. No, stopping terrorism, that's the key. And it goes back and forth, and doesn't lead to much united advocacy. There are other sort of things about this. You know, I take, because I am Lutheran, I'm a pretty shallow Lutheran. I mean, I became a Lutheran when my wife got her first parish. You know, so I surrender. I was a general Protestant until then and figured, well, you know, Lutheran is just Lutheran. I had worked in a Methodist church, United Church of Christ, for 3 years. Keep the house together. And by the way, Carol didn't push me on this. She probably lost the job because she responded to a call committee saying she didn't know whether I'd become Lutheran. if she got the call. I'll take the Lutheran. You know, the Lutheran Church has adopted a campaign called Peace, Not Walls. Well, you know, at first blush, at least among non-Jews, it seems so simply clear and moral. Course, peace, not walls. Referring, of course, to the wall that the Israelis are building. Just seems simple and clear. I mean, it's just, of course, peace, wall, you know. I mean, even though the slogan, what, fences make good neighbors or something, you know, good fences make good. But, you know, it's right on the surface. It seems simple and unassailable as a proposition that peace is different than walls. On the other hand, if you're a Jew, what you think of when you think of the wall is some, at least symbolic and maybe real protection from suicide bombers. So you say, wall, not suicide bomber. And you can, I mean, very quickly be in an argument about those, from those two points of view, and both of them, in a certain sense, have real moral validity. I think, anyway, real moral validity. But maybe that's not the best way to talk about the situation, you know, to get dug in one of those or the others. There are other examples like that, but I'll just leave that for now and then come back to why, when I talk about united advocacy for Arab-Israeli-Palestinian peace, I'm not just blowing smoke. I mean, you know, I mean, it could have been like, well, this guy's sort of, you know, he's into inter-religious cooperation, so he's got to sort of believe that it's possible. But in fact, there's some real things happening that are very encouraging in this way. And I think the basis of why there is new cooperation going on in this country in advocating for peace is basically a reflection of the change in the conflict. That is, I referred to the conflict for 40 years being a conflict where each side wanted the other to disappear. It has evolved into a conflict where majorities on both sides accept the idea there have to be two states. That Israel must continue to exist, and there has to be a Palestinian state alongside Israel, with both living in peace and security as neighbors. Well, that's quite an evolution of the conflict. It took a long time to get there. And, you know, various people say, well, only if they got there earlier, it would have been better. Well, of course. But, you know, if we had ended slavery earlier, it would have been better, too. But, you know, history takes its time, and we take our time. The conflict has evolved, and the reason I say the late 80s, it was in 1988 when the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, for the first time officially adopted a position which said
they accepted Israel's existence and would negotiate peace with Israel based on the UN Security Council Resolution 242. And that was an official position by the PLO. The trend toward that position among Palestinians had started in the 70s, but was a minority position. I mean, they literally voted on these things in the Palestine National Council. That was a minority position. It wasn't until 1988, long after the 67 war and the West Bank and Israel captured the West Bank and Gaza in that war, it was, you know, 11 years after that, the PLO finally got to take this position. And I say finally, not in a judgmental way, because, you know, you understand why it took that long. Well, Israel did not accept the idea of negotiating with the PLO until 1990s. Even when the Madrid Peace Conference took place in 1991, the one that Bush Sr. organized in Madrid, the Israelis would not agree to a PLO delegation being at the table. The Palestinians had to come as part of the Jordanian delegation because Israel wouldn't talk directly with the PLO. Once the talks got started, it was very clear that the Palestinians in the Jordanian delegation were those with whom Israel was really negotiating and that they were all PLO. But there had to be a kind of fig leaf over that reality for the Israelis to enter into negotiations. So it wasn't until 1990 that Israel got around to accepting the idea that they were going to have to negotiate with the PLO and that there was probably going to be a Palestinian state. So having said that, that evolution of the conflict toward a point in the last 5 years where a majority, something on the order of 55-65% of Palestinians, 55-65% of Israelis, accept that there will be two states and accept the outline of the compromises that will be necessary to have two states. For example, accept the idea that refugees, Palestinian refugees, will not all return inside Israel, because if they did, it would, their population-wise, they would outnumber the Jews, and there wouldn't be any more Jewish state. There'd be that. And on the issue of Jerusalem, accept the idea that they're going to be both capitals, both Palestine capital and Israel's capital are going to be in Jerusalem. This is now accepted as the image of how the conflict will be resolved by, as I said, 55-65%. That shift in the nature of the conflict has caused a shift here among groups that heretofore have been fairly partisan and antagonistic to each other. And I've listed a whole bunch of websites for groups up there. I put Nili on the top, of course, because I work with Nili, but starting with the one in the upper left-hand corner, which is Churches for Middle East Peace. That's a coalition of all the major Protestant groups and some participation by the Catholics. And then Peace Now, which is a Jewish group, Americans for Peace Now. The next one is the American Task Force on Palestine, which is a Palestinian-American group that when they have their annual dinner in the fall, get about 500-600 Palestinian-Americans come to it. Well, I put the ELCA, the Lutheran website. Then the second column, that stands for Britzedek B'Shalom. This is a new, in the last 3 years, more activist Jewish peace group working specifically on lobbying Congress and the administration. They got quite strong and quite active. Then the Israel Policy Forum is a very mainstream Jewish group. Just to show how mainstream it is, on its board are about 5 or 6 former presidents of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, which is the major umbrella group in the Jewish community. In other words, it would be the heads of American Jewish Congress, American Jewish Committee, Hadassah, et cetera, et cetera, the religious organizations. And IPF is an independent group, but they are very mainstream. Then the next one, AAI, is the Arab American Institute, then the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. And a very interesting, the newest group over on the right-hand column called J Street, which is a Jewish lobby for peace. Well-funded, not nearly as well-funded as AIPAC, which is the Jewish lobby or the Israeli lobby that we've all probably heard of, but very interesting, very challenging, very, what do I want to say, sort of, if you read that, they just did an ad in the New York Times, they have a sort of brassiness about them, which is fun, particularly in the Jewish community. I mean, you know, Jews are good arguers. I think it started with arguing over the text and the meaning of the text in the Torah. So J Street is important for non-Jews to look at because it gives you a glimpse of a whole set of alternative opinion in the Jewish community to what we hear often is the official opinion from, say, AIPAC, the Israel, what is called the Israel Lobby. So there's a convergence now of advocacy among these groups that is, and it's developed over the last 3, 4, 5 years. And if you went back 5 or 6 years, you would have found these groups occasionally looking askance at each other and sort of identifying each other as simplistically partisan this or that. So Churches for Middle East Peace was viewed in the Jewish community, even by some of these Jewish peace groups, as pretty much pro-Palestinian. And now that's not the case. In fact, now there is, and it's interesting, this is done quietly because each group wants to maintain its own integrity in its own community. In other words, you know, a Jewish peace group doesn't want to look like it's somehow a front for a Presbyterian group. And, you know, a Lutheran group wants to look like it's genuinely Lutheran, not somehow doing the work of the Jewish peace group. So they don't, they haven't formed a formal coalition, but I can tell you that their staff people meet together in Washington. They're on the phone together all the time when something's happening. For example, I'll give you an example. Syria indicated it was interested in negotiating with Israel. Some Israeli leaders seemed to indicate they were interested in negotiating with Syria. The U.S. said to Israel, we don't want you negotiating with Syria because they're part of the axis of evil. I mean, this is all literal news of the last year or so. Churches for Middle East Peace talked to Americans for Peace Now, Jewish group, and talked about, they agreed, yeah, it's good, they negotiate. And so they both took the same position. They took it separately, but when they went into congressional offices were hearing positive stuff about why it was good that Israel and Syria were negotiating and why the U.S. should support them. So this convergence is a new development, an encouraging development, and I would say it's the sort of range of advocacy that I would hope we'd all join. And let me just say that there are options to joining this sort of new convergence. For example, in the Christian community, on one end, you have Christians United for Israel, John Hagee. Probably not a favorite pastor among you all, but among some Christians, certainly is. This is a group that sees everything the Israel government does, particularly when it's warlike, as positive. The group gets a little nervous when Israel does something peace-like, partly because of their end-times theology. You know, warlike fits more with Armageddon and end-time stuff. I mean, it's a bit, you know, it seems to me ridiculous, but it's real. I mean, in their life, they gather 3,000-4,000 people in Washington. They take plane loads to Israel, which, by the way, in Israel, the hawkish elements in Israel continue to rally with what are called Christian Zionists, Christian diehard supporters of everything Israel does. The dovish Israelis tend to ignore them or stay away from them. So it's not as if, you know, Israelis all rally around these groups. But so that's one example on one end. On the other end, I have to put Sabil. Sabil is a sort of Christian-Palestinian solidarity group, which if you read their stuff, as I say, it's there's a convincing thing about it because Palestinians are going through hell. So, you know, you want to be in solidarity with Palestinians, it makes some sense. But they're outside of this convergence in terms of what we should advocate together. So I would, in terms of church group, I think Churches for Middle East Peace is the best bet, and Lutheran, Presbyterian, other denominations are in that and in it solidly. Now, the top one, the one I put up there in the box, NILI. 2003, NILI was formed. It was formed by heads of religious organizations I mentioned before. One of the conversations I like to cite that was at the beginning of it was the head of all the Reform rabbis had a phone conversation for about a half an hour with Bishop Mark Hansen, head of the ELCA. And when I asked each of them, you know, how it went, they both felt very good about it and both said the same thing. The basic thing they got out of the conversation is that sometimes they were going to have to hold their tongues. Meaning, just very simply, that, you know, certain things would happen that Mark, given his connection to the Palestinian Lutheran bishop on the ground, would feel a need to speak out and condemn or whatever. And there were certain things that would happen that Rabbi Menatov would feel the urge to speak out. But if you're going to work together, you might be advised to first call the other one and say, well, how do you react to what just happened? And in fact, this is something I've suggested locally to local religious leaders. Look, if something happens that you think is particularly good or particularly bad in this conflict, call someone. If you're a Lutheran pastor or a Presbyterian minister, call a rabbi friend and ask him how he sees it before you get up in the pulpit or before you put something in your newsletter, and see how he sees it. See if there's some way that maybe you can nuance what you say that takes a little bit more account of how the person connected on the other side of the conflict might have seen. And obviously you can do that with Muslims, you can do that. And let me tell you, it's not done very well. That is to say, you know, clergy, anybody or activists on these issues don't feel the need to consult someone who's going to sort of mess up their clear perception. I mean, they don't think of it that way. They don't think, oh, I'm going to keep my perception clear, you know. But there's just sort of a natural inclination. I mean, you've been working on this. You know what you know and you need to know. And, man, I'll say my thing. That was a terrible thing, and that hurts the chances for peace. And then you talk to somebody from the other side, but did you understand why that happened? Is that important to understand? Is that important to include in how you react? So, anyway, these groups working together, but there are groups that AIPAC would be another example that you know, AIPAC sort of says what it says is good for Israel and sort of Palestinian point of view completely left out of that. And you know, and they're very powerful, so that has to be taken into account. So if you feel the urge to be narrowly partisan about this, there are still groups that you can work with. I don't encourage it because I think it is less than useful at a time when there is a possibility for peace. And the other thing I would say is that there's a new urgency on the issue of peace. Why? Because it took the parties, you know, some 40 years, I suggested, to get to the point where they were accepting the idea of a two-state solution. But then the possibility of a two-state solution, the time for it could run out. Why would it run out? Well, for one thing, because Jewish settlements keep expanding in the West Bank. And that's the area where there's supposed to be a Palestinian state. Well, what's going to happen to those settlements? And if there are more of them, isn't it going to make it more difficult? Well, yes, it is. It is making it more difficult. Or the growth of Hamas and Hezbollah. Do they complicate? Well, they do. When the PLO was around, it was it, you know. Now with Hamas, with its ideology of wanting an Islamic state in the whole area, whoo, that sort of makes things a little bit. So the combination of Jewish settlements and Hamas mean that to a certain extent, time is running out for a two-state solution. The Israeli prime minister put it this way. You may have seen a quote in the Atlantic magazine back in May, where he said, if the possibility of a two-state solution elapses, is over or finished, Israel is finished. He put it that dramatically, Prime Minister of Israel, which is part of what motivates Sharon before him and now Olmert to say we need to get out of these territories. We need to get out. And on the Palestinian side, I think anybody who knows the Palestinian situation would know that time is urgent there, too, to get a state for them. So that's a new urgency. And let me just conclude with a sort of practical thing of where we are today. Obviously, we're in an election season. And, you know, this issue's come up already, is going to come up more. New president's going to, whoever it is, candidates are going to be involved in it. But then whoever's the new president is going to decide where does this issue fit on a list of priorities, how urgent it is, and so forth. That decision that the president makes, whoever, McCain or Obama, is going to be a very important decision. All of these groups are sort of getting oriented toward what do we need to say to candidates? What do we need to say? What do we need to be prepared to say to a new president and a new Congress? The interreligious initiative leadership are meeting on September 3rd in Washington at a meeting hosted by Cardinal McCarrick, who was the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., and a marvelous, I mean, he's my cardinal. He's just incredibly down to earth. I mean, you know, he knows that red hat he puts on doesn't really mean that much in terms of who he is as a human being. I mean, he puts it on when he, but he's just, I mean, he introduced himself in the first conference call we ever had as Ted. The head of the Reform Rabbis called me up afterwards and said, Ron, he said, I just want to tell you something. He said, it's not politically. He said, I just never thought as a Jew that I would ever hear cardinal introduce himself as to me. If you've ever met cardinals, some of them, you know, wear their cardinalness on their sleeve. You know? Well, this guy doesn't. McCarrick doesn't. And he's just lovely. He's hosting the meeting. And we're expecting 30, 35 leaders, including, I know that Bishop Hansen is coming. And the reason for the timing of the meeting is to prepare what are our common messages for candidates and for a new president. And also, hopefully, to arrange the possibility of meetings with the two candidates by these religious leaders. So that's in the works. And following on that, I said that's going to be September 3rd. I'm going to be doing, or I certainly want to be doing, a fair amount of traveling to as many local areas around the country to speak about what the messages are that these Jewish, Christian, Muslim, religious leaders have agreed on, assuming that they agree. I mean, every meeting like this is, you know, it's another beginning. And you can't assume that it's all going to go swimmingly. But I think we'll make it through, and we'll have some messages. We'll have some ideas about what the new president should do. And I am eager to get out to as many places in the country to talk about those messages and to say, you know, that not only is peace possible, but there's some things we can do to make it more likely. So, yeah.
On your website, will it be told when you'll be where? You know.
Well, and yes, but more. You know, I do not. I wish I did. I don't have a kind of name. Who I thought of just when you said that is Michael Lerner. I know Michael Lerner puts out his schedule. I'm going to be in a bit. I need, the way I organize a trip is that somebody says, look, I could have you to an adult forum at my congregation, and we could pay you $50 or $100, $150, something like that. I take that as the basis for organizing a trip to the area and to going to. So I have to say to you, there'll be a list up there if you help me put it together.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I know our church would love to have.
Well, I'm ready. The only thing I know I'm going to Detroit area. I know that's in the works because a rabbi got that thing.
California, good place to go.
Where?
You know, Bay Area.
Yes, and I have very good contacts in what is it when you go through the tunnel to the east?
Yeah, Lafayette.
I have very good contacts there. So no, that's great. I'm ready. Let's be in touch.
This question will fit in right here, but I would love help to know how to start a conversation, you know, in a small group.
Yes.
Of people that do have pretty divergent opinions, or.
Now you mean within are all Christians, or is it inter?
Let's say. Yeah. Let's just like even a church or where I work, there's different people. Yeah, you know, just a small group of women that. If the subject comes up about the conflict.
Well, one of the things that I think is, look, one of the values of this national interreligious initiative is that you can bring to someone who may be Jewish or maybe Muslim, you can say, well, you know, it's interesting. I heard about this initiative. Look at the names of the leaders who have agreed on this kind of position. What do you think about that? And it gives you a sort of entry point where instead of bringing something that the Lutherans said to a Jewish group, you're bringing something that Jews said alongside of Lutherans and Presbyterians and Muslims. And frankly, that's the value. I think, you know, the national leaders doing something like this is important. The fact that we could get in the door and see Secretary Rice, and then subsequently we've met about every 3 months with a deputy to Rice, there's some value to that. Maybe we can get some press attention. But unless there's local expressions of a similar kind, these national leaders, it's not going to be much. I didn't be frank. I'm working on it, but I know it's not going to be much. Unless it's happening locally. So use the national initiative stuff from the website. One of the categories is advocacy statements. And the top one is always the most recent. And you can show that. You can also show to someone the principles of cooperation, which you have a copy of there. And that's on the website. Things that we agreed to that sort of are the basis for our working together. And then all these other groups, you know, if you're talking to, it'd be interesting, if you're talking to a Palestinian American, you might say, well, what do you think of what the American Task Force on Palestine is saying? Okay. Now, they may disagree with it, just as, you know, I mean, just because it's Palestinian doesn't mean people are going to agree that are Palestinian. But at least it gives you a little bit of an entree from their own community's perspective.
And are you in conversation with not Bishop, but Rabbi Lerner? I'm just curious.
Well, it's interesting. I've known Michael since he was in Seattle. I mean, I was not in Seattle, but he was in Seattle during the Vietnam days, and we go back a long way. Michael, I would say the difference is, there are some similarities. The difference is that this group includes the heads of all the Reform rabbis and the heads of all the Reform congregations. That is much more a much more mainstream cut in the Jewish community, slice of the Jewish community, and more substantial in the Jewish community than the Jewish colleagues of Michael. And that's not to put, look, I mean, it stood out outside of enough places with signs, you know, to say, and believe in doing that I'm not putting down more sort of more activist postures. But that's the difference. So in the Jewish community, some people would roll their eyes when you said Tikkun or Michael Lerner because they figure he's sort of a little bit too sympathetic to the Palestinians, even though Michael's solid on his support for Israel. Whereas if you say the head of the Reform rabbis, their eyes would not roll as quick. Yeah.
We've heard from Alan Story all about the concept of unlimited forgiveness as being deep in our Christian heritage. Is that also part of Judaism and Islam?
Yeah, well, you know, I think this is a third reason why I keep working on this. How is it that we can come to agreements? Well, it's partly political realities, it's partly realism, you know, but it's also partly some deep sources within our traditions that lead us to love of each other when it's impossible, you know, and forgiveness of each other. But I want to go slowly as to what that means, how to apply it in this situation, and want to hear from others how they think of it. There's a group in Richmond, Virginia, that I'm going to be speaking to in September that's just started a Jewish-Christian-Muslim dialogue group. And frankly, when they started, they said, but we won't talk about this issue, Israel-Palestine. Because they were, you know, you can say they were chicken, or you can say they were smart enough to know that if they talked about this issue, that might be the last time they talked. So they said, we'll avoid it. So what they did was set up some topics that they would talk about, and one of them was forgiveness. And what they agreed was each group, the Christian group, and it's a small group, it's maybe, I don't know, 25 or 30, each an equal number, that the Christian group would develop a like two-page paper on what do we mean in our tradition by forgiveness. The Jewish group would do the same, the Muslim group would do the same. And then they'd exchange. Well, they are overlapping in some ways, different in some ways. You know, I just read the Jewish paper on forgiveness, and it was fascinating. What was different about it from the way I often hear forgiveness used in the Christian context is there were levels of forgiveness. And different levels of forgiveness were one reached by different sorts of behavior and action. I mean, one level, for instance, was that you were forgiven when you apologized for what you had done. Another level was when you made up for what you had done. Because that's different than just apologizing. You know, I mean, you've hurt someone, I'm sorry. But, you know, do you help them get up and pay them money for their medical bill? Blah, 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 blah. And so it was this, but there was also in it the kind of forgiveness that we in the Christian community experience as grace. In other words, something that is like beyond reason. Beyond reasonableness. And of course, that had to do with the way God is with us. And for Jews, you know, like for Christians, God's mercy is thousands of times larger than God's judgment. Thanks be to God. I mean, you know, if it weren't, we're all in the soup deeper than we would like to be. God's mercy is much larger than God's judgment. And for Muslims, there is, you know, I don't know if you know, but every chapter of the Quran begins with the word Bismillah al-Rahman al-Rahim. And it means God who does mercy, which is a quality that can be duplicated by humans. And then al-Rahim, God who is mercy. And that is not duplicable. That is not something that humans can be. So for Muslims in the Quran, and this is the verse that begins every chapter but one of the Quran, And it suggests that for Muslims, this idea of God as mercy itself is fundamental, So I think the three traditions have it, but, you know, working on what it means without reference to this conflict is one sort of task. Working on what it means about this conflict is another sort of task. What it means in terms of Germany is another sort of task, you know. And it's really important that we, rather than rush in with our notion and say, well, do you have the same thing? It would be interesting, I think, a better approach to say, how do you approach the idea of forgiveness when it comes to this conflict? I mean, you even think of it, you know, and hear what's said. The rabbis taught that the reason God gave us two ears and one mouth is that we're to listen twice as much as we speak. At which point I said the other day, if my wife were here, yeah, Ron. I saw in the back, yeah.
This is a much less weighty question. It's a geography question.
Yes.
How can there be a contiguous Palestinian state and not interrupt a contiguous Jewish
state? It's good, it's good. I'm not going to mess around with colors here. When I do maps, I often try to use blue for Israel. And... Whoops, oh man. Let's see. All right. Here we go. More magic? More magic? Huh? Probably let me end of the week here or something. All right, that's roughly, so say, here's the West Bank, here's Gaza. And obviously, the talk is about a two-part Palestinian state. Contiguous, mainly, that phrase has mainly been used in regard to the West Bank because of the Jewish settlements in there. And so the question is, what's going to happen with those settlements? And the idea is that the settlements that are very close to the line here will probably be incorporated into Israel as part of Israel, not taken into Israel, but that piece of the West Bank would be incorporated into Israel, and that the Palestinians would say they have to get an equal amount of land, say, on the southern end of the West Bank or next to Gaza, one for the land they're willing to give up to incorporate those settlements. Settlements that are deeper in the West Bank would have to go. They'd have to be withdrawn, just as all the settlements were withdrawn from Gaza. Palestinian general who had fought the Israelis in Lebanon, and when I met him was in charge in Gaza of security, said to an interfaith group, he said, you know, I just want to say something personally. He said, I'm not speaking now for the Palestinian Authority. I want to say personally, I hope that some Jewish settlements would remain inside the West Bank and would be part of the Palestinian state, recognizing that they would be under Palestinian law. But he said, I think it's much healthier if some Jews are living in a Palestinian state rather than not living, none of them living there at all. Mm-hmm. Now, he said this back in 1988. Mm-hmm. And whether the bitterness of conflict between then and now means that that's not a possibility, it's interesting that he said it. Because I think it's true that it would be healthier if. But so that's, all right, so probably many of these settlements will have to be removed. Between the West Bank and Gaza, even in the Oslo process, there were negotiations which actually succeeded. They were concluded that provided for two roads, one that would connect Gaza to near Ramallah up here, and the one that would connect Gaza to somewhere near Hebron, down in the southern part of the West Bank. And the way the roads would work is that the ends of the roads would be controlled by Palestinians, Palestinian Authority. And any egress or entry onto the road while it was passing through Israel would be controlled by the Israelis. A sort of practical compromise arrangement, which meant, of course, that as compared to now, where Israelis control Palestinian traffic from Gaza to the West Bank, which is devastating on Palestinian society and people, what would be true is Palestinians could get on the road in Gaza, uninterrupted by Israelis, under only Palestinian authority, and travel all the way to the West Bank without interruption. Another idea that the RAND Corporation has come up with, they've done a wonderful study, a very creative study that's been talked about a lot among Palestinians and Israelis on the ground, is they had an idea for a rail line, elevated rail line, for commerce and people that would go from Gaza, come into the West Bank here at Hebron, and go north. So it would connect all of these towns and cities of the West Bank. But it'd be elevated, so the complication of going through Israeli territory would be eliminated. So those are the ideas. And it's, you know, those are the kind of ideas when people are forced to sit in a room and come up with solutions, and they're motivated by wanting to go home. Well, no, I talked to Palestinian and Israeli negotiators who negotiated an agreement about how they were going to patrol during Oslo in areas that were called the sea areas. And these were areas that weren't going to be officially controlled by the Palestinians or the Israelis. So what do? Well, politicians turned this problem over to the military people. And they sat in a room at a hotel and began to negotiate. One of them said, well, maybe we should have joint patrols. And everybody laughed. Everybody, you know, said, yeah, right. You know, they were picturing these kids who had been fighting each other, getting in a jeep together. Well, after 4 days, somebody said, what was that idea? Because they were, you know, damn it, we want to go home, you know, we're missing our family. And so they came back to this idea, and by God, they came up with it and agreed with it, and they did it. They had orange flags on the jeeps, and Palestinian and Israeli soldiers sat in the jeeps together and patrolled together. Now, the first day, as this guy told the story, he said, the first couple of days, he said that their guns weren't pointed out, their guns were pointed in toward each other, you know. So he said, we understood that we had to make these boys go through some workshops. And so they went through workshops, and you know, after like a month, they were stopping for coffee. Now, you know, that you don't want to get schmaltzy about that, but it does say something about the practicality of a union management negotiations. You know, after a while, you say, well, you know, that idea isn't so bad.
Right.
Yes.
The whole rapture thing, you know, Christian Zionist movement, how major has that been, actually?
Well, it's interesting. David Neff, who's the editor of Christianity Today, is one, and Christianity Today, you know, is sort of the magazine of evangelicals, just like Christian Century has been sort of the magazine of Christian liberals. David Neff said, based on a study that he did or had done, that Christian fundamentalists who hold that sort of view are probably somewhere around 15-10% of Christian evangelicals who hold the sort of rapture type view. Now, he said, you know, it's a slippery thing. Those numbers are slippery, and more people may have read the books, the series, what is it called?
Left Behind
series. More people may have read that than that percentage. But he's saying hardcore who have those beliefs about the rapture and the end time stuff, he thought 10-15%. Also, he said that the survey showed that some 65% of conservative evangelicals would support a two-state solution. And just in the last year, and this is something on the NILI website you can find, there have been two major statements signed by prominent conservative evangelicals calling for a two-state solution and urging U.S. leadership to help achieve it. And they met with President Bush. They actually more easily have access to Bush than our initiative does. And in our initiative, four or five of the leaders are from the conservative evangelical movement. Obviously, they're not rapture people. So it's had effect. Obviously, in the context, not by itself, but in the context of the influence of conservative right-wing Christian community, it's had its effect. And one of the papers there is some comments I made on critiques of Christian Zionism. And Christian Zionist, as it's the term is used, refers to Christians out of this orbit, very conservative evangelical, very much, quote, for Israel, like John Hagee, and I think rightfully need to be critiqued. From my point of view, part of the problem as they get critiqued is that it's not clear among much of the criticism whether the critics themselves accept the legitimacy of Zionism or not. And Zionism is Jewish nationalism. It's the basis for the creation of modern Israel. And I can say myself, I accept that. I don't accept it because I think there's no other concept of how people can live together. I accept it because I understand and accept that the Jewish people felt a deep longing for a self-determination as a people. which is different than as Lutherans. I don't think we have that. That's not in us, you know. We're not, in that sense, tribal. And I don't mean tribal in a negative sense. I just mean it in a, this is the reality that, that for Jews, their peoplehood is a very important reality. And as a people, they've had a long-term longing for being able to express that peoplehood in a nation. And that was reinforced by their historical experience in which they felt they had to express it in the form of a nation because otherwise they wouldn't be saved. And what I'm saying is that I think Christian, that when in critiquing Christian Zionists because of their, what they, Christian Zionists tend to do is they identify with the most hawkish elements in Israel. The most hawkish elements. And in a way, they do a disservice to Israel itself by that kind of approach. But in critiquing it, I think as non-Jews, we still have some way to go to understand Zionism, to understand the impulse of Jewish people. And I mean, as my Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, whose name you may know, I've been involved with for a long time, said that he realized during the Six-Day War that his Christian friends, Christian clergy friends whom he adored, they were very close to each other, basically thought of him as a Unitarian with a kippah. In other words, they thought of him as in the same category, sort of, that it was your beliefs that made you a Jew, like as a Presbyterian or a Lutheran, that's your beliefs. But for Jews, it's something much more, it's deeper, not better, but deeper. It's a sense of we are a people. And so you can be a Jewish atheist, a Jewish, you can, and you know, I sat next to a Jewish atheist in synagogue one night, you know, and he said, you may not want to sit right next to me. I said, why? He said, well, you know, I don't believe all this stuff. He says, it's all mythology. I said, but the rabbi said to sit here. I said, I don't know about you. But in other words, you can, the religious belief is not the central thing for Jews. Peoplehood is. Yep.
You know, the same thing is true for the Muslim community. Their whole basis is the Ummah, which is the word for community.
Mm-hmm.
And so Muslims around the world are all part of the same community.
Yeah, it's complicated for Muslims. I mean, you know, we're into, part of the fun of working together on this issue is that it leads you into discussions like this, which go deeper and broader. I think part of it's complicated for the Muslims because the Muslims believe that Adam was a good Muslim. In other words, they take sort of the oneness of God and the oneness of people and do something different with it, neither tribal nor creedal exactly. They believe that Adam was a good Muslim. So before Muhammad, there was Muslims. Well, you know, John says in the gospel, doesn't he say, before, how does it go? That he has Jesus saying, you know, sort of,
before Abraham
I was, you know. What the hell is that about? I mean, you were just born in Bethlehem at a certain time. So how is it that before Abraham you were? Well, take that in your pipe and smoke.
Yeah. Huh? Same idea.
Same idea. So the Muslims, well, it's complicated. I mean, obviously Muslims have believed in the idea of an Islamic realm, an Islamic state, and that being the ideal. And obviously that would make Jews itch. I mean, Israelis itch a little bit about what does that mean. Well, when I talked to the theologian for Hezbollah in 1985, named Mohammed Fadlallah in Beirut, and when I asked him about this, I said, well, how do you put together your vision of one Islam, the whole world, and the idea that the Palestinians might accept a state alongside Israel? How do you put those? He said, if the Palestinians accept a state alongside Israel, this is good, this is okay, we will accept this. He said, the idea of an Islamic state, he said, this is a theological idea. This is a... So he was able to sort of distinguish between a vision which he believed in and a practical historical reality, you know? Now, not all Muslims do. I mean, some Muslims compress those two things and say there has to be an Islamic state in all of Palestine. No, that won't work with Israel there. But we have Christians like that too. So, well, I think we're heading to lunch. Are we okay? Maybe five minutes or something? I have 10 of them. we're still okay. Any other questions or comments? Yeah.
Whatever became of Netanyahu.
Netanyahu. Well, he's still around, and he is. If Olmert is forced out of office, you know, there's a whole big thing about scandal about Olmert. If he's forced out of office, the polls say that Netanyahu could be the next prime minister, and he is much more hawkish than Olmert. You know, Olmert and he both were both members of the Likud coalition, which is a conservative, more hawkish coalition. But Sharon split that coalition when he formed a new party called Kadima, as he made the decision that the Israelis should pull out of Gaza. The more hawkish elements in the Likud did not go with Sharon on that, and Netanyahu is one of them. Olmert went with Sharon on that, said we got to pull out of Gaza, and is prepared, he says, for Israel to pull out of most, maybe 90-some percent, of the West Bank. By the way, Olmert's family is an interesting thing. His wife is a long-term dove, and both his sons refuse to serve in the army in the West Bank. So dinner table conversations must be quite something in his house.
Yes. In the Tuesday session, you had the handout of the Geneva Agreement.
Yes.
And you said that was the foundation of which, you know, peace could be achieved.
Yeah.
In your view, in your vision, what do you think could happen to take that forward to achieve that in the near term?
Yeah, Geneva Accord, you can go online. I mean, I have a few more copies of the summary of it, but you can go on the NILI website, and there's a summary of the Geneva Accord. This was an unofficial peace agreement worked out by prominent Israelis and Palestinians, many of whom had been in the official Israeli-Palestinian negotiations prior to this working on this unofficial one. It's worth reading because it spells out, the summary certainly is worth reading, it spells out in some detail how to resolve the issue of borders, settlements, refugees, and Jerusalem in a way that would be acceptable to both sides. And as I said, 60% support both sides. How do we get there? What's important? Well, one of the things our group has been advocating to the administration is that we think this administration, Bush, Rice, or a new administration, should make reference, positive reference, to this unofficial agreement, to its content, even if you don't use the name of it. For instance, the idea of a shared Jerusalem. We think our administration should say publicly that we understand that there have been talks between Israelis and Palestinians which have come up with ideas for how Jerusalem not will be divided, but will be shared. Very important different word for Jews. If you hear divided, you hear Berlin Wall. You hear Jews not being able to get to the temple, etc. But shared is something different. So we think the administration should say this. Now, when we talked with Rice, this is where back rows come in handy. When I'm in a meeting with Rice, with these religious leaders, guess which row I'm in?
Yeah.
And she has her back row people, and the religious leaders have their back row people. When the religious leaders were in the meeting with Rice, Rice made a big point of saying, well, now we as Americans, we cannot say what the solution should be. This is up to the Israelis and Palestinians. Well, in principle, that is right. But the fact is that the Geneva Accord is something the Israelis and Palestinians came up with. In fact, the origins of it were in 1996 during the Oslo process, when part of the Oslo agreement was that you leave certain tough issues like refugees, Jerusalem, etc., to the end. Mahmoud Abbas was asked by Yasser Arafat, and a man named Yossi Beilon, Israeli, was asked by Rabin to begin some informal talks to see what ideas they could come up with for resolving these issues. So in 1996, they began this, and they had teams that worked with them. It was all hush-hush. I mean, it wasn't out in the public. But they had these talks, and I led an interfaith group of Jewish, Christian, Muslims leaders to Jerusalem precisely at that time, 96, spring 96, and we were able to talk with people who were part of that process, Israelis and Palestinians, and hear the ideas that they were beginning to talk about, like how to share Jerusalem. So when Rice says we can't push our ideas, our response was, look, these ideas came from Israelis and Palestinians. And what you can do is give a kind of visibility to them, give a kind of, at least in principle, support for these kind of ideas. Now, they're reluctant to do it. They're reluctant to do it partly for the moral principle, but they're also reluctant to do it because they know it'll cause some political flak. In other words, for instance, AIPAC might say, if Rice were to say, well, we know there's going to be a shared Jerusalem, AIPAC might respond very heatily to that, saying, oh, it's the United Undivided Capital of Israel. The fact is that other Jewish leaders would be supportive of that. So it's going to cause some political flak, but good things sometimes take some political flak, you know, take some flapping around a little bit. So that's one of the things I think that the administration needs to do, and I would hope, you know, Obama went to AIPAC, gave a talk, which I think was a good thing to do, and he came out and sort of, he said the sort of mantra about Jerusalem, undivided chair. But it's interesting, the next day, his top campaign staff were quoted in Haaretz, the big daily newspaper in Israel, saying, well, yes, he did say that, but he also said that the issue of Jerusalem must be negotiated and it must be agreed to by both parties what the solution would be. And when he said that, some of the more hawkish elements in the American Jewish community attacked him, saying, well, you said undivided, da, da, da. Now you're saying, so, you know, he did both things. He was campaigning and he did this thing. So our argument would be there are ways that American political leaders, including maybe candidates, but certainly a new president, because candidates, you know, they're trying to get into the office. When they get into office, they have a little bit more freedom. That candidates maybe, but certainly a new president can say some things that suggest U.S. support for these compromise ideas. Now, it's interesting. Bush has already said some positive or things of supportive for the idea of compromise on the refugee issue. But that is that refugees would not all come back inside Israel. Well, that statement of support for compromise obviously favors the Israelis. Because it's an emotional issue for the Palestinians. Where are these refugees? What's going to happen to these refugees? If a political leader were to make a statement of Jerusalem, that sort of makes the Israelis nervous and Jews nervous. And so what we would suggest is that you talk about both of them and you say, look, there are going to be compromises. They're going to be tough compromises. They're going to be emotionally hard things to do. But we know that Israelis and Palestinians already are talking about these ideas. And we support, in principle, ideas that would work, would be workable. You know, you can, you know, between me and Obama, there's a long distance in terms of getting to say that. But that's the kind of thing I think people can.
Thank you.
Yep, you're welcome.